Chapter 40. By gentlemen at the hardships and privations of a frontier life have rendered Mr. Davis tough. But, gentlemen, is this a time to cavil at toughness? Is this a time to be fastidious concerning trifles? Is this a time to dispute about matters of paltry significance? No, gentlemen, bulk is what we desire, substance. Wait, bulk, these are the supreme requisites now, not talent, not genius, not education. I insist upon my motion. Apostrophe, apostrophe, Mr. Morgan, excitedly, colon, apostrophe, Mr. Chairman, I do most strenuously object to this amendment. The gentleman from Oregon is old, and furthermore is bulky only in bone, not in flesh. I ask the gentleman from Virginia, if it is soup we want instead of solid sustenance, if he would delude us with shadows, if he would mock our suffering with an Oregonian specter. I ask him, if he can look upon the anxious faces around him, if he can gaze into our sad eyes, if he can listen to the beating of our expectant hearts, and still thrust this famine-stricken fraud upon us. I ask him, if he can think of our desolate state, of our past sorrows, of our dark future, and still unpityingly foist upon us this wreck, this ruin, this tottering swindle, this gnarled and blighted and sapless vagabond from Oregon's hospitable shores? Never. Apostrophe, applause. The amendment was put to vote, after a fiery debate, and lost. Mr. Harris was substituted on the First Amendment. The balloting then began. 5 ballots were held without a choice. On the 6th, Mr. Harris was elected, all voting for him but himself. It was then moved that his election should be ratified by acclamation, which was lost, in consequence of his again voting against himself. Mr. Radway moved that the House now take up the remaining candidates and go into an election for breakfast. This was carried. On the first ballot there was a tie, half the members favoring one candidate on account of his youth, and half favoring the other on account of his superior size. The president gave the casting vote for the latter, Mr. Messick. This decision created considerable dissatisfaction among the friends of Mr. Ferguson, the defeated candidate, and there was some talk of demanding a new ballot. But in the midst of it a motion to adjourn was carried, and the meeting broke up at once. The preparations for supper diverted the attention of the Ferguson faction from the discussion of their grievance for a long time, and then, when they would have taken it up again, the happy announcement that Mr. Harris was ready drove all thought of it to the winds. We improvised tables by propping up the backs of car seats, and sat down with hearts full of gratitude to the finest supper that had blessed our vision for 7 torturing days. How changed we were from what we had been a few short hours before. Hopeless sad-eyed misery, hunger, feverish anxiety, desperation then, thankfulness, serenity, joy too deep for utterance now. That I know, was the cheeriest hour of my eventful life. The winds howled, and blew the snow wildly about our prison house, but they were powerless to distress us any more. I liked Harris. He might have been better done, perhaps, but I am free to say that no man ever agreed with me better than Harris, or afforded me so large a degree of satisfaction. Messick was very well, though rather high-flavored, but for genuine nutritiousness and delicacy of fiber, give me Harris. Messick had his good points, I will not attempt to deny it, nor do I wish to do it, but he was no more fitted for breakfast than a mummy would be, sir, not a bit. Lean? Why, bless me. And tough? Ah, he was very tough. You could not imagine it, you could never imagine anything like it. Do you mean to tell me that? Do not interrupt me, please. After breakfast we elected a man by the name of Walker, from Detroit, for supper. He was very good. I wrote his wife so afterward. He was worthy of all praise. I shall always remember Walker. He was a little rare, but very good. And then the next morning we had Morgan of Alabama for breakfast. He was one of the finest men I ever sat down to, handsome, educated, refined, spoke several languages fluently, a perfect gentleman he was, a perfect gentleman, and singularly juicy. For supper we had that Oregon patriarch, and he was a fraud, there is no question about it, old, scraggy, tough, nobody can picture the reality. I finally said, gentlemen, you can do as you like, but I will wait for another election. And Grimes of Illinois said, gentlemen, I will wait also. When you elect a man that has something to recommend him, I shall be glad to join you again. It soon became evident that there was general dissatisfaction with Davis of Oregon, and so, to preserve the goodwill that had prevailed so pleasantly since we had had Harris, an election was called, and the result of it was that Baker of Georgia was chosen. He was splendid. Well, after that we had Doolittle, and Hawkins, and McElroy. There was some complaint about McElroy, because he was uncommonly short and thin, and Penrod, and two Smiths, and Bailey. Bailey had a wooden leg, which was clear loss, but he was otherwise good, and an Indian boy, and an organ grinder, and a gentleman by the name of Buckminster, a poor stick of a vagabond, that wasn't any good for company, and no account for breakfast. We were glad we got him elected before relief came. And so the blessed relief did come at last? Yes, it came one bright sunny morning, just after election. John Murphy was the choice, and there never was a better, I am willing to testify. But John Murphy came home with us, in the train, that came to succor us, and lived to marry the widow Harris, relict of our first choice. He married her, and is happy, and respected and prosperous yet. Ah, it was like a novel, sir, it was like a romance. This is my stopping place, sir, I must bid you goodbye. Any time that you can make it convenient to tarry a day or two with me, I shall be glad to have you. I like you, sir. I have conceived an affection for you. I could like you as well as I liked Harris himself, sir. Good day, sir, and a pleasant journey. He was gone. I never felt so stunned, so distressed, so bewildered in my life. But in my soul I was glad he was gone. With all his gentleness of manner and his soft voice, I shuddered whenever he turned his hungry eye upon me, and when I heard that I had achieved his perilous affection, and that I stood almost with the late Harris in his esteem, my heart fairly stood still. I was bewildered beyond description. I did not doubt his word. I could not question a single item in a statement so stamped with the earnestness of truth as his. But its dreadful details overpowered me, and threw my thoughts into hopeless confusion. I saw the conductor looking at me. I said, "Who is that man?" He was a member of Congress once, and a good one. But he got caught in a snowdrift in the cars, and like to have been starved to death. He got so frostbitten, and frozen up generally, and used up for want of something to eat, that he was sick, and out of his head 2 or 3 months afterward. He is all right now, only he is a monomaniac, and when he gets on that old subject he never stops till he has eat up that whole carload of people he talks about. He would have finished the crowd by this time, only he had to get out here. He has got their names as pat as AB-100. When he gets them all eat up but himself, he always says, then the hour for the usual election for breakfast having arrived, and there being no opposition, I was duly elected, after which, there being no objections offered, I resigned. Thus I am here. I felt inexpressibly relieved to know that I had only been listening to the harmless vagaries of a madman instead of the genuine experiences of a bloodthirsty cannibal. The Killing of Julius Caesar, Ocelized, written about 1865. Being the only true and reliable account ever published, taken from the Roman Ali Evening Fasces, of the date of that tremendous occurrence. Nothing in the world affords a newspaper reporter so much satisfaction as gathering up the details of a bloody and mysterious murder and writing them up with aggravating circumstantiality. He takes a living delight in this labor of love, for such it is to him, especially if he knows that all the other papers have gone to press, and his will be the only one that will contain the dreadful intelligence. A feeling of regret has often come over me that I was not reporting in Rome when Caesar was killed, reporting on an evening paper, and the only one in the city, and getting at least 12 hours ahead of the morning paper boys with this most magnificent tem that ever fell to the lot of the craft. Other events have happened as startling as this, but none that possessed so peculiarly all the characteristics of the favorite tem of the present day, magnified into grandeur and sublimity by the high rank, fame, and social and political standing of the actors in it. However, as I was not permitted to report Caesar's assassination in the regular way, it has at least afforded me rare satisfaction to translate the following able account of it from the original Latin of the Roman daily evening fasces of that date, second edition. Our usually quiet city of Rome was thrown into a state of wild excitement yesterday by the occurrence of one of those bloody affrays which sicken the heart, and fill the soul with fear, while they inspire all thinking men with forebodings for the future of a city, where human life is held so cheaply, and the gravest laws are so openly set at defiance. As the result of that affray, it is our painful duty, as public journalists, to record the death of one of our most esteemed citizens, a man whose name is known wherever this paper circulates, and where fame it has been our pleasure and our privilege to extend, and also to protect from the tongue of slander and falsehood, to the best of our poor ability. We refer to Mr. J. Caesar, the emperor-elect. The facts of the case, as nearly as our reporter could determine them from the conflicting statements of eyewitnesses, were about as follows. The affair was an election row, of course. 9/10 of the ghastly butcheries that disgrace the city nowadays grow out of the bickerings and jealousies and animosities engendered by these accursed elections. Rome would be the gainer by it if her very constables were elected to serve a century. For in our experience we have never even been able to choose a dog pelter without celebrating the event with a dozen knockdowns, and a general cramming of the station house with drunken vagabonds overnight. It is said that when the immense majority for Caesar at the polls in the market was declared the other day, and the crown was offered to that gentleman, even his amazing unselfishness in refusing it three times was not sufficient to save him from the whispered insults of such men as Casca, of the 10th Ward, and other hirelings of the disappointed candidate, hailing mostly from the 11th and 13th and other outside districts, who were overheard speaking ironically and contemptuously of Mr. Caesar's conduct upon that occasion. We are further informed that there are many among us who think they are justified in believing that the assassination of Julius Caesar was a put-up thing, a cut-and-dried arrangement, hatched by Marcus Brutus and a lot of his hired roughs, and carried out only too faithfully according to the program. Whether there be good grounds for this suspicion or not, we leave to the people to judge for themselves, only asking that they will read the following account of the sad occurrence carefully and dispassionately, before they render that judgment. The Senate was already in session, and Caesar was coming down the street toward the Capitol, conversing with some personal friends, and followed, as usual, by a large number of citizens. Just as he was passing in front of Demosthenes and Thucydides' drugstore, he was observing casually to a gentleman, who, our informant thinks, is a fortune teller, that the Ides of March were come. The reply was, "Yes, they are come, but not gone yet." At this moment Artemidorus stepped up, and passed the time of day, and asked Caesar to read a schedule, or a tract or something of the kind, which he had brought for his perusal. Mr. Decius Brutus also said something about an humble suit which he wanted read. Artaxnidorus begged that attention might be paid to his first, because it was of personal consequence to Caesar. The latter replied that what concerned himself should be read last, or words to that effect. Artemidorus begged and beseeched him to read the paper instantly.
Mark that. It is hinted by William Shakespeare, who saw the beginning and the end of the unfortunate affray, that this schedule was simply a note discovering to Caesar that a plot was brewing to take his life.
However, Caesar shook him off and refused to read any petition in the street. He then entered the Capitol, and the crowd followed him. About this time the following conversation was overheard, and we consider that, taken in connection with the events which succeeded it, it bears an appalling significance. Mr. Papilius Lena remarked to George W. Cassius, commonly known as the Obby Boy of the Third Ward, a bruiser in the pay of the opposition, that he hoped his enterprise today might thrive. And when Cassius asked at enterprise, he only closed his left eye temporarily, and said with simulated indifference, "Very well," and sauntered toward Caesar. Marcus Brutus, who is suspected of being the ringleader of the band that killed Caesar, asked what it was that Lena had said. Cassius told him, and added in a low tone, "I fear our purpose is discovered." Brutus told his wretched accomplice to keep an eye on Lena, and a moment after Cassius urged that lean and hungry vagrant, Casca, whose reputation here is none of the best, to be sudden, for he feared prevention. He then turned to Brutus, apparently much excited, and asked what should be done, and swore that either he or Caesar would never turn back, he would kill himself first. At this time Caesar was talking to some of the backcountry members about the approaching fall elections, and paying little attention to what was going on around him. Billy Trebonius got into conversation with the people's friend and Caesar's Mark Antony, and under some pretense or other got him away, and Brutus, Decius, Casca, Cinna, Metellus Cimber, and others of the gang of infamous desperados that infest Rome at present, closed around the doomed Caesar. Then Metellus Cimber knelt down and begged that his brother might be recalled from banishment, but Caesar rebuked him for his fawning conduct, and refused to grant his petition. Immediately, at Cimber's request, first Brutus and then Cassius begged for the return of the banished Publius. But Caesar still refused. He said he could not be moved, that he was as fixed as the North Star, and proceeded to speak in the most complimentary terms of the firmness of that star and its steady character. Then he said he was like it, and he believed he was the only man in the country that was. Therefore, since he was constant that Cimber should be banished, he was also constant that he should stay banished, and he'd be hanged if he didn't keep him so. Instantly seizing upon this shallow pretext for a fight, Casca sprang at Caesar and struck him with a dirk, Caesar grabbing him by the arm with his right hand, and launching a blow straight from the shoulder with his left that sent the reptile bleeding to the earth. He then backed up against Pompey's statue, and squared himself to receive his assailants. Cassius and Cimber and Cinna rushed upon him with their daggers drawn, and the former succeeded in inflicting a wound upon his body. But before he could strike again, and before either of the others could strike at all, Caesar stretched the three miscreants at his feet with as many blows of his powerful fist. By this time the Senate was in an indescribable uproar. The throng of citizens as the lobbies had blockaded the doors in their frantic efforts to escape from the building, the sergeant-at-arms and his assistants were struggling with the assassins. Venerable senators had cast aside their encumbering robes, and were leaping over benches and flying down the aisles in wild confusion toward the shelter of the committee rooms, and a thousand voices were shouting, "Police! Police!" in discordant tones that rose above the frightful din like shrieking winds above the roaring of a tempest. And amid it all, great Caesar stood with his back against the statue, like a lion at bay, and fought his assailants weaponless, and hand to hand, with the defiant bearing and the unwavering courage which he had shown before on many a bloody field. Billy Trebonius and Caius Ligarius struck him with their daggers and fell, as their brother conspirators before them had fallen.
But at last, when Caesar saw his old friend Brutus step forward armed with a murderous knife, it is said he seemed utterly overpowered with grief and amazement, and, dropping his invincible left arm by his side, he hid his face in the folds of his mantle, and received the treacherous blow without an effort to stay the hand that gave it. He only said, "Et tu, Brute?" and fell lifeless on the marble pavement. We learn that the coat deceased had on when he was killed was the same one he wore in his tent on the afternoon of the day he overcame the Nervii, and that when it was removed from the corpse it was found to be cut and gashed in no less than 7 different places. There was nothing in the pockets. It will be exhibited at the coroner's inquest, and will be damning proof of the fact of the killing. These latter facts may be relied on, as we get them from Mark Antony, whose position enables him to learn every item of news connected with the one subject of absorbing interest of today. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.